This morning, America's First News starts right after this.
How would you love a chance to save some money on car insurance? GEICO can help. Switch today and see all the ways you could save with great rates and discounts. It's easy. Simply go to geico.com to get a rate quote and get started seeing how much you could save.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This morning, with your host, Gordon Deal.
States versus the CDC. Good morning, I'm Gordon Deal, along with Jennifer Koschenka, on this Thursday, February 10th. Glad you could be with us, and here's what we have for you this hour.
New York, Illinois, Washington, and Rhode Island, the latest states lifting some mask mandates, but government health officials are not in favor.
The White House has approved a plan to help Americans leave Ukraine if there's a Russian invasion.
In addition to new quarterbacks at the Super Bowl, there will also be a new advertising theme, commercials for cryptocurrency.
And the reason America does not have enough truck drivers.
And a lot of this has to do with not enough drivers. And this is, you know, because drivers now have other things to do. I mean, there are labor shortages throughout the economy.
Yeah.
And it's just harder and harder for companies to retain their people.
Peter Goodman at the New York Times profiles the difficult job of over-the-road trucking. Drivers who are gone from home a long time. Ford and Toyota are halting some production as vaccine mandate protesters block U.S.-Canada border crossings. The protests have caused gridlock in Ottawa since late January, and since Monday night, truckers shut inbound Canada traffic at the Ambassador Bridge, a supply route for Detroit's carmakers and agricultural products. On top of that, there's now an estimated 9-mile traffic jam at the Blue Water Bridge in Port Huron, Michigan, where commercial traffic was rerouted when the Ambassador Bridge was closed. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau.
Even as Canadians are tired and impatient for it to end, we are going to continue to be there for them, to support them through it, and to make sure we do everything necessary to end this pandemic.
Toyota, by the way, said it's not expected to produce vehicles at its Ontario sites for the rest of the week, and output has been halted at a Ford engine plant. Another border crossing in Alberta province has been closed in both directions since late Tuesday. The first U.S. troops reinforcing NATO allies on the eastern flank have arrived in Romania, a response to a Russian military buildup on Ukraine's border. The United States is sending nearly 3,000 extra troops to Poland and Romania to bolster eastern European defenses. In Romania, it's relocating a Stryker squadron of U.S. service members from Vilsack, Germany. Also, White House spokeswoman Jen Psaki says a plan has been approved for U.S. troops in Poland to help thousands of Americans likely to flee Ukraine if Russia attacks.
There are a range of means that individuals and Americans can depart from Ukraine, and we've been encouraging them to do exactly that.
Meanwhile, Romania says part of the new Stryker squadron, which will be named Task Force Cougar, will make its way across the country to a military base on the Black Sea. Romania also hosts a ballistic missile defense system. The Stryker squadron, designed to deploy on short order, will add to the 900 soldiers the U.S. currently has rotating in Romania. As we previewed, New York State will end a mandate requiring face coverings in most indoor public settings, but will keep school masking rules in place, and Illinois will follow a similar path, although local jurisdictions and businesses are free to impose their own. They are the latest in a series of states to roll back mask mandates amid a decline in daily coronavirus infection and hospitalization numbers. Still, the director of the CDC recommends masks in most areas of the country. Rhode Island Governor Dan McKee.
We are lifting Rhode Island's statewide mask or proof of vaccination protocol for indoor public settings beginning Friday, February 11th.
That's tomorrow. Elsewhere, Washington Governor Jay Inslee announced that an outdoor mask requirement for people at gatherings of 500 or more would end next Friday, and he announced an end to the pause of elective surgeries starting that same day. Also, the U.S. is planning to roll out COVID shots for children under the age of 5 as soon as February 21st. We all have a lot going on. The last thing we need is to spend too much energy choosing what to wear. But if you have a closet full of Cuts clothing, it's easy. Throw on anything and you'll look good. How do they do it? Every Cuts shirt is designed for a modern, tailored fit. They're insanely comfortable. I can't believe how soft their shirts feel. Between the fabric and the fit, they're the most comfortable shirts
I've ever worn. Plus, Cuts has all the essentials for looking sharp, like tees, hoodies, polos, and more. And they reinvented them all, from how they're cut to the revolutionary fabrics they use. They won't shrink, pill, or fade over time in the wash. Mine still look and feel great. Try them for yourself and save. Join hundreds of thousands of guys who've made the simple decision to elevate their wardrobe with Cuts. Get 15% off your first order by going to cutsclothing.com/Gordon. That's C-U-T-S, cutsclothing.com/Gordon for 15% off the only shirt worth wearing. cutsclothing.com/Gordon. Thanks for spending time with us, Republican Representatives Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia, Madison Cawthorn of North Carolina, and Lauren Boebert of Colorado have built national reputations and raised millions of dollars by flouting political norms. Now the so-called MAGA axis of the House freshman class is attracting Republican challengers. Here's Stephanie Aiken, politics and campaign reporter at CQ Roll Call. Stephanie, what are you seeing?
You know, as the primary season is starting to get underway, we're seeing the same pattern emerge in a lot of Republican primaries where there are candidates who are more on the extreme right, populist, MAGA axis of the party versus candidates who are a little bit more traditional Republicans who are talking about moving back to the nuts and bolts of lawmaking, especially as Republicans are in a position where they're very confident about winning the House majority. And these three races are ones that have attracted a lot of attention across the country because the Republican incumbents, who are all freshmen, are Republicans who have received a lot of attention for their antics that some people on the left and, frankly, some Democrats find a little too inflammatory.
All right. So, example for Marjorie Taylor Greene, the congresswoman from Georgia, her opponent in the primary is who and is saying or doing what?
Well, she does have several opponents in the primary, so it's not really clear who's going to come out ahead. But the one that I focused on is a woman named Jennifer Strahan, who is getting some support nationally and some support within the state Republican Party. So she's one who's kind of coming out front as somebody to watch. She is somebody who's also new to politics. She has not held an elected position before. She's a healthcare consultant. She pitches herself as a no-nonsense conservative businesswoman. She's Christian. She's very conservative on all of the policies. She's pro-Trump. She's willing to say that she sees some issues with election integrity in the 2020 election, although she does say that Joe Biden won the election. But on all of these hot-button topics that have really divided the parties recently, she is, clearly on the right. But her main issue with Marjorie Taylor Greene is that this is somebody who seems to be more interested in having a public persona and marketing herself than in actually getting in there and doing the nitty-gritty work that comes with governing and being in Congress. Also because Marjorie Taylor Greene has been stripped of her committee assignments so she's not even doing the work on the Hill that lawmakers traditionally do when they're going out and representing their constituents.
We're speaking with Stephanie Aiken, politics and campaigns reporter at CQ Roll Call. Her story is called Along With Attention, GOP House Firebrands Attract Primary Fights, and she's focused in on Georgia Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene, North Carolina's Madison Cawthorn, and Colorado's Lauren Boebert. So explain who's running against Cawthorn and Boebert, for example, North Carolina and Georgia, North Carolina and Colorado, respectively.
Yeah, so again, these are races that are just starting to come online. North Carolina, the congressional maps just got thrown out in a state court, so it's not even clear if these districts are going to be the same. But in that race, Madison Cawthorn, he announced in December that he was going to switch districts and run in what is now the newly drawn 13th district, which is one that, at least at this point, is one that is a little bit more Republican-leaning. And that's shocked a lot of people because there's a state lawmaker is pretty high profile in the state who everybody assumed was going to run there, and they thought that the district was drawn for him. And as soon as Cawthorn said that he was going to run there, this guy, I think his name's Tim Moore, he said that he wasn't going to run. He was going to clear the way for Cawthorn. And the assumption at that point, I think a lot of people thought, all right, well, this is Cawthorn's race. The state party is just going to fold to this. But now it seems like there's a little bit of pushback. I mean, these are, you know, in all three cases, they're people who have not made a lot of friends in the sort of traditional party apparatus in their state.
Wow. All right. So as you point out in the story, though, it's going to be a tough time regardless for a Democratic opponent here in either of these three races or any of these three races.
Well, there are Democrats who are running in all of these races, but these are very solidly Republican districts, but they are all districts that are going to be really hard for Democrats to win.
All right, Stephanie. Stephanie Aiken, politics and campaign reporter at CQ Roll Call. By the way, you may see this on social media. Congresswoman Taylor Greene apparently trying to accuse Nancy Pelosi of Gestapo police tactics, but instead she said gazpacho, the chilled soup. It's 19 minutes after the hour on this morning. Here's Jennifer Koshenka.
And now, the three big things you need to know. Number one.
A blockade of the bridge between Canada and Detroit by protesters demanding an end to Canada's COVID restrictions forced the shutdown of a Ford plant and began to have broader implications for the auto industry. But Prime Minister Justin Trudeau stood firm against an easing of Canada's COVID restrictions in the face of mounting pressure during recent weeks of protests.
You need to end the pandemic by relying on science, by public health measures, and by vaccinations.
The Ambassador Bridge carries 25% of all trade between the U.S. and Canada.
Number two.
Russia is set to begin 10 days of military exercises with its neighbor Belarus as tensions remain high over a large buildup of troops along its border with Ukraine. NATO says 30,000 Russian troops are believed to be in Belarus to take part in the exercises. Russia continues to deny it is planning to invade Ukraine as a global diplomatic standoff continues.
Number three.
Senators have struck a bipartisan deal to reauthorize a landmark domestic violence bill after Democrats dropped their effort to add contentious language related to guns. The agreement came hours after an emotional appeal by actor and humanitarian Angelina Jolie.
Anyone who's been in those situations will tell you just how far they feel from the power concentrated here in this building. The power to pass laws that might have prevented their pain in the first place.
The Violence Against Women Act was enacted in 1994 to provide funding for prosecutions of domestic violence crimes, as well as shelters and other programs to aid victims of abuse. It lapsed in 2019. The House committee investigating the January 6th Capitol riot has issued a subpoena seeking testimony and records from Peter Navarro, who had served as trade advisor to former President Trump. The committee says it wants to question Navarro because of his own published statements indicating he was involved in efforts to delay Congress's certification of the results of the 2020 election. The housing market has been booming since the start of the pandemic, but many people who got swept up in bidding frenzies are regretting their purchase. Zillow's new survey on buyer's remorse finds 75% of recent home buyers have at least some. Top regrets include the fact that their home needs more work or maintenance than buyers wanted, or the purchased home feels too small.
That's a lot of overbidding money to have regrets about.
Yep.
Thank you, Jen. Glad you could be with us. Welcome into Thursday. Who will dominate Super Bowl 56? Madison Avenue's money is on crypto. Paul Vigna at the Wall Street Journal says cryptocurrency exchanges are shelling out top dollar to run ads during this Sunday's Super Bowl between the Los Angeles Rams and Cincinnati Bengals. Paul, what are we going to see?
You are going to see the Los Angeles Rams take on the Cincinnati Bengals. Both hoping to win the championship of the NFL. You are also going to see a number of ads from cryptocurrency companies. I think they're all exchanges, frankly. So you are going to see ads talking about cryptocurrencies, promoting cryptocurrencies, really. And what's interesting about it is that this is the first time any of these companies have bought ads on the Super Bowl. So this is, you know, crypto has been this sort of hot fad for a while. It's been just a ton of money that's poured into it over the last couple of years. And because they have so much money, these companies are starting to set their sights on the biggest stages they can find, thus Super Bowl ads.
We're speaking with Paul Vigna, cryptocurrencies reporter at the Wall Street Journal. His story is called Bengals, Rams, and Bitcoin Crypto Ads Invade the Super Bowl. The NFL is getting in on it too, right? With non-fungible tokens. What's happening here?
Yeah, in a way, they're going to... So non-fungible tokens, briefly, they're basically digital collectibles. So think of any kind of an artwork, any kind of a ticket, like what the NFL is doing for the game. It's basically a one-of-a-kind digital representation of a real-world thing. So what the NFL is doing is they're going to give out NFTs of the tickets, which, I mean, Gordon, you and I are big football people from way back when. Mm-hmm. To me, the collectible was always the ticket stub.
Yes, yes, right? Yes.
I still have ticket stubs from, championship games of 30 years ago.
Right.
They're going to give out digital versions of that. Wow. That's really all it is.
Okay.
Everyone is sticking their toes into this NFT pool, this idea. They're playing around with it. It's kind of an interesting thing. It's arcane to a lot of people. The platforms for buying and selling them are not accessible to a lot of people. Okay. And I don't mean that you can't go on it. I mean that it's really hard to figure out what's going on if you're not already familiar with crypto. So it's not the easiest thing to just kind of jump into, but everyone is jumping on that bandwagon.
All right. I know you know it because you've written a couple of books about it too, but without making most of our eyes glaze over, explain what Miller Lite is doing with the crypto-themed campaign. The bar.
So Miller, it's interesting because Budweiser owns the exclusive rights to advertise for beer companies during the game. So Miller Lite can't buy an ad during the game. So what they're doing is they're going to run an ad, but they're going to run it on a virtual platform called Decentraland. And if you've heard of the metaverse, it's one of these metaverse-like platforms. It's basically just a VR environment where anybody can kind of go and walk. It's like a big video game, really, is what Jeez. It is. So Miller Lite has set up a virtual bar inside this virtual environment where I guess you could virtually get drunk. I don't know how that really works. And inside of this also, they are going to run their Super Bowl ad. So that's how it's interesting because that's how they get to capitalize on all the zeitgeist and all the buzz, right? There's Super Bowl buzz, there's crypto buzz, there's metaverse buzz, beer buzz. They just capitalize on all of it. So that's how they're getting into it.
Thanks, Paul. Paul Vigna, reporter at the Wall Street Journal. 30 minutes now after the hour on This Morning, America's First News. So I got to say, 2022 kind of feels like Groundhog Day. Wake up, read a headline about inflation, repeat, right? Inflation, inflation, inflation on the rise at the fastest pace in 40 years. But you don't need to check the price of organic eggs to know it's probably not the best time to put all your investment eggs in one basket. I'm talking about diversifying your portfolio. And thanks to today's sponsor, Masterworks, you can now add an exciting asset class to your portfolio, blue chip artwork. Masterworks is the new investing platform that lets everyone invest in contemporary art from icons like Picasso, Monet, and Warhol. In fact, early investors already have seen over 30% net annualized IRR in 2020 and 2021 from the sale of two paintings. No wonder the Wall Street Journal recently called the art market among the hottest markets on earth. Our listeners can join over 300,000 members and access their latest offerings at masterworks.art/Gordon. That's masterworks.art/Gordon. See important disclaimers at masterworks.io/disclaimer.
No fear, just facts. This is America's First News, This Morning with Gordon Deal.
Thanks for being with us. Welcome into Thursday, February 10. Gordon Deal, Jennifer Koshenka, some of our top stories and headlines. More states lift mask mandates. Biden okays a plan to help Americans leave Ukraine if Russia invades. Disney Plus subscriptions beat expectations, and the company reported record park and resort revenue. Comedian Bob Saget died from a brain bleed, it turns out, after he went to sleep, not realizing the extent of a head injury. American gold at the Olympics for figure skater Nathan Chen and snowboarder Chloe Kim. NBA trade deadline this afternoon, and the friends who've attended every Super Bowl. That story in about 20 minutes. Well, in a world contending with the unrelenting impact of the great supply chain disruption, and as part of that, rising consumer prices, a shortage of truck drivers is frequently cited as an explanation for shortages of many other things, from construction supplies to electronics to clothing. Peter Goodman, global economics correspondent at the New York Times, rode along in a big rig for a couple of days to get a feel for what's happening in the industry. Peter, your takeaways.
Well, you know, I rode in a truck for 3 days from Kansas City down to Fort Worth, Texas, and back. I mean, the quick takeaway is this is not a job that most people will want to do. I mean, it's a tough way to make a living. You're sleeping in a truck most nights. You're on the road for weeks at a time. You're away from family. It's almost impossible to have any real personal life. You're subsisting on, you know, whatever you can find at a gas station, at a truck stop, microwave burritos, shrink wrap sandwiches. There's not a lot of fruit and vegetables involved. There's a lot of coffee. You're trying to avoid highway hypnosis, but you don't want to have to stop too much to go use the restroom. So these are the thoughts that are filling the heads of truck drivers.
All right, so you rode with this Stephen Graves, right? He's 65 years old. He's been at it for a couple of decades now. What does he say?
Well, he says he's fairly satisfied. He's working for one of the better trucking companies. This is a company with merely a 65% turnover rate, meaning it has to replace its truck driving shifts, 65% of them.
Wow.
In the course of a year. That may strike some people as not a particularly good rate of retention, but it compares to an industry average of about 95% turnover.
Goodness.
You know, he didn't want to discuss what he earns, but he clearly is paid pretty well for a truck driver. He takes vacations to places like Australia, Bulgaria. And he's a guy who's kind of made peace with, I'm a loner. I'm on the road for 3 weeks at a time. He's given up any possibility of a relationship. He doesn't have kids. And he will go home to his condo in Kingsport, Tennessee, and just lay around and cook a little bit and rest up. And then he goes back out on the road and spends his time on the interstates.
Yeah. That does sound tough. You know, what struck me too in your story was because I've been sort of saying this all along, wow, we need more drivers. Somebody suggested that this notion that there are too few drivers is bogus. Where'd that come from?
Yeah. So there's an academic at the University of Pennsylvania who actually drove a truck as part of his graduate research and wrote a terrific book called The Big Rig. This is a guy named Steve Viselli. And he notes that, you know, the industry itself in its analysis will tell you that there are roughly three times as many commercial driver's license holders. That's the license you need to operate a tractor trailer as there are positions needed. He says it's a scam that essentially the industry burns out recruits. They suck them in to these kind of predatory leasing arrangements with their trucks. They charge them for the training programs they run to get a commercial driver's license. Most people don't stick. They can't handle the time away from family, the hours, the usually disappointing pay, because these guys spend a lot of time just sitting around waiting for their loads, time that they're typically not paid for. And so people are constantly leaving, and they need to keep recruiting. So the way they do that is they keep saying there's shortages, and they're trying to get federal subsidies for more training.
We're speaking with Peter Goodman, global economics correspondent at the New York Times. He's also author of a book called Davos Man, How the Billionaires Devoured the World. This piece in the Times is called The Real Reason America Doesn't Have Enough Truck Drivers. So if it's always been about the pressure and the loneliness and the not great pay, why is it surfacing now? I mean, hasn't this always been a problem then?
Well, it always has been a problem, but, you know, we're living in this time of what we're calling the great supply chain disruption. I mean, the pandemic has produced this surge of orders for things that people need in their homes as we've outfitted our bedrooms and offices, and we've been dealing with cooped up children. We're buying iPads, office furniture, baking goods. We're turning our basements into gyms and bringing in exercise bikes. So the whole supply has been overloaded by this surge of factory goods, most of them made in Asia. And we see all the vulnerabilities that have been there throughout, but now there's a breakdown. I mean, we don't have enough drivers to move goods from warehouses to where they're ultimately going, to customers or to retailers. And as a result, containers are piling up on the docks at major ports. And a lot of this has to do with not enough drivers. And this is, you know, because drivers now have other things to do. I mean, there are labor shortages throughout the economy, and it's just harder and harder for companies to retain their people.
Thanks, Peter. Peter Goodman, global economics correspondent at the New York Times. Again, his book is called Davos Man: How the Billionaires Devoured the World. Thanks for spending time with us. Welcome into Friday Eve. It is time now for the Mic Drop with this morning's Mike Gavin.
Good morning. Well, if you've been listening to us for some time now, you know that sometimes the weird news starts to follow a trend, and we might have one on our hands here. This week, we've already had no less than three incidents coming from all corners of the world of people getting worked up over discovering what they think are dead bodies, only to find out that they're mannequins. The first story came out of Georgia, where police near Atlanta rushed to a forest following reports of a deceased female that was found face down on a hiking trail. Fortunately, it was only a life-size doll dumped by an unknown litter bug. Travel to the UK now, where a man looking for driftwood after a storm came across what also appeared to be a deceased female face down on the sand with no clothes on. Turns out that victim was also a life-size doll. And finally, we travel as far away as Malaysia, where police found what appeared to be a body wrapped in plastic sheets behind a motorcycle shop, which turned out to be a discarded mannequin. No word from any of these authorities as to what might be behind this sudden rash of doll dumpings.
That is weird. Creepy and weird.
Yeah, my only thought is maybe, remember all those stories we did about people putting mannequins in their cars for the HOV lane situation? Maybe, you know, people are like, you know what, this isn't working. We're getting caught by the cops. So they're just dumping all these mannequins now. You know, what are you going to do with a mannequin, right? If you're not going to use it for something like that, what are you going to do with it around your house? So maybe that's why they're getting rid of them now. It's the only thing I can think of.
Well, how about just breaking it up and putting it out in the garbage?
Oh, sure.
Yeah. There's that.
I suppose you could do that.
Yeah.
But that takes work, Gordon. And people something tells me the people who are putting these things in their car for the HOV benefit are not people who like to put a lot of extra effort into things, you know.
Okay, but there does seem to be a lot of effort for this one that was found near Atlanta.
Yeah.
Because it was found on a hiking trail.
Right.
So you gotta fireman's carry, like to carry a mannequin like out into a hiking trail and dump it.
That is true. Yeah, you do have to have a little bit of stamina there to drag something like that onto the hiking trail.
It's weird.
And we know, Gordon, that you interview a lot of people, but even with the thousands of chats under your belt, the jury is still out on whether you might be able to keep up with this pair of Ohio college students and their brand new Guinness record. Zachary Sinutko and Colin Kennedy hopped on John Carroll University's radio station recently and interviewed each other for more than a day. In total, they talked for 25 hours and 35 minutes, setting the Guinness record for longest consecutive radio interview. They beat the previous record by 9 minutes, set just last year by a DJ in Nepal. The two told a local TV station that they did it for the publicity, hoping to get more attention for the show they host together, which seems to have worked out pretty well for them.
And since both you and I worked for college radio stations, we are willing to give them the publicity.
Yes.
Nicely done.
Yes, we are. Can you imagine an interview for 25 hours and 35 minutes? That's something you do when you're like 20 years old, right?
I guess.
Right?
Yeah.
I'm not sure. Not sure either one of us are equipped for that at this point.
I can understand food and getting through with food and drink. I don't know how they handled bathroom breaks. Do you just go on a solo chat by yourself for a few minutes while one guy darts out?
That's a good question. They didn't say anything about bathroom breaks. I'm sure there are some rules. Guinness usually has certain rules about those kind of things. So maybe they were allowed to leave maybe like for 5 minutes at a time or something. But then, what does the person do in the meantime? Right. I guess they just talk to themselves, interview themselves.
Right.
Ask themselves some questions.
I was born a young child. Very good.
How would you love a chance to save some money on car insurance? Geico can help. Switch today and see all the ways you could save with great rates and discounts. It's easy. Simply go to geico.com to get a rate quote and get started seeing how much you could save.
Thanks for being with us. Don't forget, by the way, we can connect on social media. You could friend us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at This Morning Show. You can follow me directly on Twitter at Gordon Deal. America's latest shortage is of disposable cups, a potential energy crisis, right, for an up-and-atom nation accustomed to coffee on the go. A Starbucks spokesman told the Wall Street Journal it's working to get more 24- and 30-ounce cups. At Wetzel's Pretzels, a chain known for its hot pretzels and lemonade, franchise holders have joined forces to scour the inventory of local restaurant suppliers and Amazon. Kari Parker, co-owner of Connie's Chicken and Waffles in the Baltimore area, said restaurants there have a handshake deal to share high-demand supplies, keeping track of who owes whom. The journal says that's helped, but the cup shortage has revealed a complementary catastrophe, lid scarcity. And one lid that seals a 24-ounce cup might fit poorly on another, risking the dreaded beverage dribble. It's 8 minutes now in front of the hour on This Morning. Once again, here's Jennifer Koshenka.
And now, the three big things you need to know. Number one.
The Department of Homeland Security has warned law enforcement agencies a convoy of truckers protesting COVID vaccine mandates could affect the Super Bowl in Los Angeles. The DHS has issued a bulletin saying it's received reports of truck drivers planning to potentially block roads in major metropolitan cities in the U.S., in protest of vaccine mandates for truck drivers. This comes as Canadian truckers have been protesting for nearly 2 weeks in Ottawa.
Number two.
New York and Illinois are ending mandates requiring face coverings in most indoor public settings, but will hold off on changing rules for schools. The news comes as the pace of new coronavirus cases has fallen by more than two-thirds from its peak weeks ago. CDC Director Rochelle Walensky.
The current seven-day daily average of cases is about 247,300 cases per day, a decrease of about 44% over the previous week.
Number three.
At his annual Super Bowl news conference, NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell was grilled on two hot topics that have put the league under heavy scrutiny: racism and discrimination in hiring. A week after former Dolphins coach Brian Flores filed a lawsuit alleging both racism in the league and being offered money by team owner Stephen Ross to tank games, Goodell vowed action on several fronts.
You know, you've had people look at that, help us independently say, is there something flawed with our process? And if there is, what can we do to resolve that and fix that?
The league also moved to take over an investigation into alleged sexual harassment by Washington Commanders owner Dan Snyder, saying the league, not the team, will hire an investigator to lead the probe. Bob Saget's death last month stemmed from an accidental blow to the head. The actor's family says authorities concluded Saget accidentally hit the back of his head on something, thought nothing of it, and went to sleep. Saget was best known for his roles on Full House and America's Funniest Home Videos. More generosity from a country star. Dolly Parton's theme park, Dollywood, says it will pay for tuition fees and books for all its employees who choose to pursue further education. Parton has long been associated with Goodwill, including funding research for Moderna's COVID vaccine and raising money for Smoky Mountain wildfire victims in 2016.
Nice. Thank you, Jen. Thanks for being with us. Three friends who have attended every Super Bowl are hoping for a memorable contest this year because it will probably be their final trip to the big game as a group. The three men are all in their 80s and have attended every game since the first AFL-NFL World Championship game was held 55 years ago. They're meeting up today in L.A., but future meetings are in question. Don Chrisman, a Maine resident, eldest of the group at 85. Then there's 82-year-old Gregory Eaton of Michigan and 80-year-old Tom Henschel of Florida. In recent years, they've come to grips with the fact that it must come to an end one day. Their small club of fans who have been to every Super Bowl has dwindled over the years as other members have aged or passed on. Mr. Eaton says he shelled out about $2,500 for his ticket this time, about 400 times more than the cheap seats cost back in 1967. And at this year's game, they'll be able to sit together again, as is their common practice. They were several rows apart at last year's Super Bowl in Tampa because of COVID restrictions. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koshenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Morning, America's First News.